Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Yes, it does. And we are live, as always, from the NASDAQ market site overlooking New York's Times Square. And this is Fast Money. I am Brian Sullivan. And for Melissa, once again, your traders on this record-setting Boxing Day edition are Tim Seymour, Dan Nathan, and two very special guests, Gina Sanchez and Victoria Fernandez. Tonight on Fast, Amazon amazes the stock, having one of its best days of the year. We're going to find out what is behind the post-holiday surge. Plus, Tim, he's got a fast pitch on this housing-related name, why he thinks this stock will nail it, hint, hint,
you know that,
in the new year. And later on, return to sender. You may have already returned that ugly Christmas sweater you got from your brother-in-law you really don't even like that much. But what if you could return the one ugly stock that you own? The desk will give us the names that they would like to ship back. All that ahead. But we start with the nonstop rally on Wall Street. The NASDAQ hitting another major milestone, crossing above 9,000 for the first time ever. Records, they just keep falling. Stocks, they just keep climbing. And fundamentals, Tim Seymour, they don't seem to matter much.
No, they don't. You can find an argument for valuations within mega cap tech, I think. If you look at Intel, if you look at Cisco, I don't think you can really make that argument with Apple anymore. And the interesting thing about, if you look at the triple Qs or the ETF for the NASDAQ 100, or you just look at the NASDAQ 100, we all know that Apple dominates this index. And this is Apple, you know, pick whatever point in the road you want in 2019, it's 70% from June. It's 50% from August. 50% for Apple from August. And that's, you know, that's how you're going to get to a NASDAQ at all-time highs. You have Microsoft and Apple leading the way. Today, you got a little Amazon for good luck, but Amazon's largely been out of this.
Which is amazing, Dan, because Apple, 28% this quarter, 50% since August, and yet we talk about the slowdown in iPhone sales from China. That's why I was sort of alluding to the fact that fundamentals, I'm not saying don't matter, I probably shouldn't have said that, but considering the news around Apple, we haven't had any good news, has been concern, and yet all it does is keep going higher.
Well, I guess the bigger issue is that Apple started the year on January 3rd, 2019, guiding down China iPhone sales in the quarter, just ended down 35%. So here they were working off a very low base all year as far as expectations. Now we have a year, the trailing 12 months, you had earnings and sales that were flat year over year from the prior year, but you have a stock that's up 82% on the year. So it started the year at 14 times, where people at that point were saying, if China's slowing and iPhone units aren't growing, 14 times is kind of expensive because we're seeing a deceleration in services. So now you have a stock that's up 100% in this calendar year, up 82% of the year. It's gained $600 billion in market cap. And it didn't grow earnings or sales last year. It's trading at 22 times forward.
Sounds like Dan's a little bearish here.
And and 24 times trailing.
It's gained a Facebook in market
cap
almost.
What that means is you've just had massive multiple expansion. When you see that sort of action, that is anticipating a lot of good news to come. If it doesn't come, you're going to have a stock that's going lower.
And that's the problem, actually. In fact, if you look, that's a broad market story as well. That's not just an Apple story. We've seen it across tech. We've seen it across the S&P. We've seen it across the NASDAQ. Is you've seen nothing for earnings all year. In fact, it's been a real earnings glut because we moved so much of the tax incentives in order to buy so that earnings were really great last year and then they were really rough this year. And all we have seen is expectation. That multiple expansion makes up for more than 100% of what we've experienced.
But that multiple expectation, too, you have to look at. I mean, it used to be seen as just a hardware company, right? And it's shifted now. If you think of it as a software company, a revenue-generating company from subscribers, from 2018 to 2019, you had a 38% growth in subscribers. Now you've got streaming services that are coming in. I mean, I actually signed up last week for it. You know, I didn't have it before.
What's on Disney Plus? I mean, is there anything?
Apple Plus.
I mean, Apple Plus. Sorry. Yeah. The morning show.
Right.
And it's worth buying it. Go out and buy it.
So there you go. So there is potential, and we can't forget we have 5G coming as well. Obviously, that's going to actually help the hardware component that has been struggling.
But I got to, don't yell at me, Tim. I'm going to defend Dan. Not that he needs defending.
What did I say?
You said he was bearish.
Yes.
And I think Dan's only point was, if you're buying it, you're buying it because you're anticipating good news. You're hoping You're paying for the good news. About the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not saying go out and buy Apple after up 83% year to date. By the way, it's annualized at 80% for this decade. So this is actually not that much of an outsized move for Apple. Everything we're all saying here, I think, is actually somewhat consistent, which is that the stock has re-rated. The stock trades at 20 times forward on a blended multiple, right. Victoria, which gets you into services and digital and a hardware multiple. The hardware multiple has re-rated because we've got wearables growing 25%. So,
right, but getting to Victoria's point, all of that now is priced in, and that's Dan's point. Yes, it's good stuff. It is going to make a difference at some point. However, you're already paying for it.
If I need to be the bad guy on this desk tonight, I will be that
guy. Well, to be fair, I think you've been long Apple.
I'm not sure how I became the blazing Apple, but I'm just putting out some
options. You know why? I came in this morning, you looked at me wrong. I said, it's Tim's night.
I got plenty of this. Take it on.
Well, I do think it's interesting because we talked about MAGA. It's Microsoft, Apple, Google, and Amazon, and they're about $4.3 trillion in market cap. They make up almost 40% of the NASDAQ 100. When you look at the outsized gains of Apple, of Microsoft, up 56%. Google. Obviously, Amazon. Well, Google's up 30%. Google actually underperforms the NASDAQ. I think that's having its own multiple issues. You would call it cheap, but maybe there's some issues about what their expected growth is. And then Amazon has really trying to grow into this multiple, but it's lagged the S&P and the NASDAQ, actually. So I guess my concern is when you say it's annualized Apple at 80% over the last decade, I'll say to you it's $1.3 trillion. It's a massive percentage of the S&P 500. And you always say there's money on the sideline. People don't own it for the next 10-year, whatever the next leg is. I'll tell you they do right now. And it may take some time to digest.
I agree. And just some perspective, Brian, because I know we got to keep moving. But think about where NASDAQ is. If you took it from the highs of Jan 2018, that blow off top, or you could even have taken it from October. We're up 14% from October of 2018. We're up 22% from January of 2018. It's not as if it's been a tear. It's been a tear the last 3 weeks to month. And certainly, but if you look at it on an annualized basis over the last couple of years with a lot of volatility, it's not like it's been that
outside. I hear that, but there was a theme that we talked about in the halftime report today, Victoria, which is this FOMO, this fear of missing out. And the idea that if you're running money for clients, you have to own certain stocks but when they get their forms, the early next year, you're going to say, why didn't you own Amazon? Remember, you know, there will be blood. Why don't I own this, right? Why don't I own this? And you feel like they might be coming in and buying these stocks just to say, look, we own that, even if they don't like it. And I wonder what will happen next year.
Well, you don't want to chase the market, right? So obviously, if you don't own a stock, you have a reason not to have that in your portfolio. Stand by that. Let your clients know why. I mean, we just added Amazon. I know we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but we just added Amazon over the last couple of weeks into our portfolio. So we've had that conversation with clients. But looking forward.
You just did.
We did. We did. We just added it.
Where have you been the last 20 years, Victoria?
Well, we were looking at the balance sheets, looking at the cash flow.
Why is that?
Wait a minute. You sound like one of her clients.
Exactly. I might be, okay? Why do you think she's on the show? I'm kidding. She's not the client. What makes Amazon now look so attractive versus a year ago, 5 years ago?
So I will tell you that just like we talk about Apple has its own ecosystem, we see Amazon now is creating its own ecosystem. They're really capturing some of that value chain by having their own delivery process that they're working on now. They have their own private label products that they're using. They've gone, obviously, and done the Whole Foods thing previously. They're really expanding, and we think that capturing that value chain is going to help the margins, which we haven't liked previously, but we see some anticipation that that's going to get better.
Yeah, I would actually echo that and say that they've hit a threshold where all of the money that they've been investing for years is starting to pay back.
Really? Yeah. You believe that? 20 years of really no profit,
the world's
no
largest
net income,
non-profit
no free cash flow.
The pushback on that is at one point it seemed a year ago that Apple was slowly growing into that valuation because, again, it's a valuation that's never made sense. But when you start to look at their ability to have some operating leverage on their business, the problem is what we're hearing out of Amazon is they're going to have to continue to reinvest, whether it's shipping, whether it's logistics or infrastructure. I don't think it really ever stops for them. The question is, what do you want to pay for it? It's been fine to pay that multiple so far.
Well, you wonder, Dan, is there some kind of a breakout? Look at that. Bring up that chart, guys, if we can again, because I think Dan's been talking about Amazon for a while, and yeah, it had a great day today. But the reality is that Amazon has not been this great moneymaker for a year and a half.
Yeah, I don't have a big problem with it. I think the fact that the stock has consolidated as the NASDAQ's gone parabolic over the last few weeks is actually kind of bullish. And so when you say to me, we're just getting in, we're getting in for the next year or two, to Gina's point about the investments they're making, I think that omnichannel approach with Brooks and Mortar, I think going and verticalizing their logistics, I think that all makes sense. But I think what we've seen in 2019 is when they have those investment periods, we've seen this over the last 20 years with the stock cools out. I mean, it just does, right? And I don't think Jeff Bezos cares. I don't think their investors have actually cared over the last 10 years. And when you think about their take rate on new online sales, they're getting 50% of all incremental online sales. You say to yourself, this is going to be a much bigger company. Right now, they have $200 billion in North American sales right now. It's just not profitable. So the other issue we didn't mention is that AWS is becoming a smaller percentage, and their margins are contracting a little bit. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I think the stock has been in a holding pattern.
Right. But I think also part of AWS really wasn't about necessarily building something for customers. It was actually getting customers to fund something that Amazon needed to build for itself. So in many ways, Amazon actually got their customers to go alongside them and help build an infrastructure that they needed anyway, and they had turned that into a business. So it was actually a bonus that it made any money.
Okay, well, one point, and I want to move on top, because I think this conversation sort of exemplifies one of the concerns people have with the market. What are we talking about? Apple and Amazon. Apple and Amazon. Every day. Right? There's a lot of other stocks. But so let's move on.
20% of the market right there.
Well, and if 50% of the QQQ is what? Five stocks?
Yes.
And you wonder if everybody's just piling into same thing. So let's move on. I want to bring up, guys, if we can, bring up the SMH or the SOX semiconductors.
Right.
Okay, because if you look at the NASDAQ 100, the last 30 days, with the exception of Tesla and I think one other name, nine of the top 10 stocks have been semiconductors. Microchip, Lam, AMD, they've all been on fire. Overcrowded semiconductor trade?
Well, if you think about semis, they've been so countercyclical relative to what we were facing in terms of trade winds. In fact, the SMH really, for a while there, looked like it hit its peak in June of 2008, and yet somehow we plowed through those highs. And if you think about a lot of the companies we've been getting updates, where you listen to Taiwan Semi, who really is essentially the white label provider for the entire industry, they're seeing enormous demand, and they're seeing it resurgent from Southeast Asia in some real growth areas. So it gets back to, though, this is a momentum trade. And if you look at some of the stocks within the SMH, they are the peak
but
of that momentum.
It. It's a momentum trade. It's not, fundamental value?
I think there's fundamental value there. I think to your point earlier that you made about this being a super cycle for some of these companies, I think semis are part of a broader super cycle. Part of what kept semis down was a lot of the noise around trade and whether or not they were going to get hit with various elements of their supply chain, what was going to happen with the U.S.-China trade deal. But if you look at sort of what has happened to semis, and they've ebbed and flowed, you know, you saw, for example, cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin create a lot of semiconductor demand. That waned. We've seen continued cloud storage continue to expand. That has created demand for semiconductors. I think that demand doesn't go down anytime soon. If anything, I think that is a super cycle we're in.
Well, and that demand and the momentum that we're talking about, that momentum is going to continue, right? When you look at markets that have had 20%+ up years, 80% of the time, the following year is positive as well, right? So we've got that momentum that's pushing. It's not just semis, it's across the board. But the demand is going to be there because the consumer is still strong. We look at the health of the consumer right now. I mean, we've got debt service ratios, the lowest they've ever been, financial obligations at 7-year lows, savings rate at 8%. That's like a 20-year high. The consumer is there, which is going to give the demand for these products. And I think semis, along with the rest of the market, is going to have that momentum going forward.
All right. Great macro discussion. So it has been a record day for your money. It's been a record year for your money. And if you bought at the 2009 lows, I mean, if you were just that good or listen to Mark Haynes, it's probably been a record decade for your money. But as the saying goes, out with the old, in with the new, as we head into the 2020s. Bob Pisani live on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. I know, Bob, you're listening to that conversation, probably just champing at the bit to jump in.
I am, but you know, it's remarkable what a decade this has been, Brian. It started out with fear, remember that? And it's ending with historic highs. Investors have been absorbed with the search for growth, which is why technology, look at this, so dramatically outperformed everything else, up more than 300% on the decade. Consumer discretionary has done well, healthcare, industrials, consumer staples. But I want to focus on the bottom sectors. There's one notable standout here. Energy, it's the only sector with no gains at all for the last decade. So what is next here? So if history is any guide, investors should avoid the fallacy that the future will look exactly like the past. We've often noted stocks and sectors that outperform one year often underperform the following year. This is called mean reversion. It's the tendency for most investments to revert to long-term averages, and it does happen over long periods of time as well. Let me show you an example. Look at 2000 to 2009. The top three sectors in that decade were energy, consumer staples, and materials. They tended to underperform in the next decade, 2010 to 2019, up only 80%. The three bottom sectors back then, communication services and technology and financials, they tended to outperform in this decade, up 184%. This phenomenon also happened from 1990 to 2000. Technology was the best performer then, and it turned into the worst performer in the following decade. So what is mean reversion? Why does it seem to work as an investment strategy? For the stock market, there's two explanations. First, in a capitalist system, underperforming sectors tend to be ruthlessly restructured until they're more efficient. Secondly, there's that old future fallacy. Humans tend to continue buying things that keep going up in value, creating bubbles that eventually burst. And Brian, of course, that's one of the tenets of the whole idea of what happened in 2008 and the problems we had in that market as well. Back to you.
I remember those days. I'm not sure a lot of other people do. Baba, you and I remember them. Thank you very much. Bob Pisani, okay. As always, really interesting historical perspective and probably important historical perspective. The question, Victoria, is we're going to ask you a very simple one because you're new to the desk here.
On the spot.
What's the market? S&P target 10 years from now is what? I'm
kidding. Higher.
I'm kidding.
It's higher.
Nice job.
I like that. Just
there we go.
Higher.
Good for you.
Okay, how about this? Next year, what do you think? I mean, to Bob's point, people buying the winter, something we kind of just talked about here. Do you like the setup for 2020?
I do like the setup for 2020, but I think the reason we're looking at, I know he's talking about mean reversion, right? And we've had the techs, the industrials doing really well over the past year, but I think they're set up well for next year also. You've got a central bank that's extremely accommodative. You've got low inflation, right? You've got companies that have been sitting on some cash that are ready to maybe put some of that to work because we've got some of the uncertainties around trade and other issues that are coming off the table just a little bit. So you're setting yourself up to allow some of those cyclical names to continue to do well next year. So I think we won't see mean reversion in the next 12 months.
By the way, I'm going to jump in because she is in from Houston.
I am.
They have a little oil and gas.
So let's talk about it.
No, but if you believe in mean reversion, that means you're a buyer of oil and gas.
Right. So sorry.
No, go ahead.
All right. So if you think about where the S&P weighting in the energy sector was in 2008, towards the end of that decade, it was almost 17%. It was 16.8% at its peak. It's 4.2% now. So you haven't had to own energy if you're a fund manager. And in fact, you could have avoided a lot of the disasters. But, you know, money, you get a lot of cliches after, you know, at the end of a decade, at the end of a year. Money is lost very quickly and it's made very slowly. And if you think about the elongated cycles, especially of energy and commodities and emerging markets, we had a period where, first of all, there's always a supply response that comes in the commodity space, whether it's oil, whether it's nickel. I mean, think about where we were at the end of the last decade, and everybody thought we were going to have a shortage of raw materials, et cetera. What happened is not only is there a technical standard deviation, the things that Bob was talking about, but there's a fundamental reason why you get this. They stopped investing in mines. He stopped investing in infrastructure around the energy sector because, in fact, a lot of this stuff was not profitable. And eventually you get to a place where supply and demand even out. I think energy will continue to outperform because I think the companies are being run for equity investors, not growth at all costs. I think emerging markets, which have underperformed for a decade, if we're getting this reflation trade, that's exactly where you're going to see the assets move.
But I'm going to put that in another perspective. Right now, investors are looking for value in their investments. And you're talking about the cheapest sectors and the cheapest areas. That's one of the reasons that you're seeing some of these. Emerging markets was the redheaded stepchild of everyone's portfolio.
I got in trouble.
But there's cheap, and there's cheap, and there's cheap for a reason, Dan.
Well, right. But if you look...
Right?
Yeah, there's cheap and cheap for a reason.
A lot of these companies, all they do is use every bit of free cash flow to pay debt service. I don't need to tell you that.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
The CEO may be out, but there's still plenty of drama at Boeing. Coming up, a new report talking about some alleged very disturbing behavior at the company. And later, home building stock stalling out after a strong start to the year. So will there be a new builder boom in 2020, especially if rates stay low? We are live from Times Square in New York City, and there is much more fast money, I'm told, right after this.
One in eight. That's how many people have worked at a McDonald's. We'll serve millions the best Big Mac and best birthday party they've ever had. Who haven't just seen kids graduate from a Happy Meal, but have gotten help graduating themselves. Because they know the skills learned here.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to English Under the Arches.
Can help you grow from here or keep growing here.
Hi, welcome to McDonald's.
One in eight, start at McDonald's. And where you start stays with you.
All right, welcome back to Fast Money. Well, the hits, they just keep on coming for Boeing and its investors. New documents under review by a congressional panel point to what some call, quote, very disturbing behavior at the company. Reuters says employees raised questions about Boeing's commitment to safety and prioritization of production schedules. Boeing issued a statement in response saying it proactively brought the documents to the FAA and Congress, but it added that the tone and the content do not reflect the company we are or need to be. This comes just days after Boeing fired its CEO, Dennis Muilenburg. Stock is still positive for the year, but it could face new headwinds into the new year. Here's Phil LeBeau with what to expect.
Next year, Boeing 737 MAX will have three critical moments. First, expect recertification early in 2020. The head of the FAA, Steve Dixon, has said he won't approve the MAX until he flies it himself. And there are still a number of hurdles to clear before the MAX takes off. But most believe it will be recertified in the first couple of months of next year. Once that happens, expect airlines to make a big push to convince flyers the MAX is safe. Southwest, American, and United have parked their MAX planes for almost a year. They know passengers may hesitate or flat out refuse to board a MAX. So executives of those airlines will be on MAX flights to reassure their customers the planes are good to go. Once the MAX is back, look for Boeing to slowly ramp up production. Yes, the assembly line will be down at the start of the year, but Boeing will likely go to building 42 a month by mid-year. What about the MAX airplanes that have been built but not yet delivered? They will eventually take off and go to the airlines that have ordered them. But it will take all of 2020 and beyond for Boeing to clear out the inventory of more than 400 MAX airplanes.
And that was Phil LeBeau with his Playbook 2020. Let's talk about Boeing. Gina Sanchez, your view on BA.
So Boeing is not out of the woods here. I think that one of the...
This feels like it's going deeper into the woods in some cases.
If anything, this is turning into... You know, everybody talks about ESG. They don't know what it is. This is an S and a G story. This is a social and a governance story. This is a story about bad governance, and you're starting to get to a point where customers are going to stop trusting the company. And once you get that, that is deep in the woods.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think... Look, this is all a cultural change at Boeing that's needed to happen, and it's easy to look back on it now and shine a bright light and say, hey, there was some arrogance, there was some obstinance with the FAA, there was a lot of missing data. We're going to continue to hear about this. But at the end of the day, you've still got the same company that people loved 2 years ago. And I think the reality is that Larry Kellner will do a charm offensive with all of the airlines as customers. He comes out of that world. I think, you know, Calhoun is somebody that's going to continue. Look, there's a journal article out today about he made a phone call and he called up the FAA and he let them know that, you know, it was a new sheriff in town and that it was an inclusive sheriff. That's really where we are.
Yeah,
although these three guys were part of the last regime,
yeah,
but they're doing their best to set a culture change.
Right, but you have two more stories, right? There was one story basically saying, by the way, Calhoun made massive donations into the GOP directly to McConnell, whose wife is the head of the Department of Transportation. That's one story.
Elaine Chao.
Yeah, Elaine Chao.
Sounds
and
like
then
business
you have,
as usual in D.C.
Right, well, perhaps, I mean, but this isn't the kind of story that sort of helps the new sheriff in town look credible. And you know, without conflict. And the second is the story that Muilenburg may walk away with anywhere from $30 to $60 million in a golden parachute,
yeah,
while you're talking about $144,000 are going to be split up between 346 victims pro rata.
All that's
a terrible story.
And you're telling a bad story. You're telling, yeah, a bad story. But if you look at Boeing and you think, it's really duopoly. I mean, I guess the worst case scenario for Boeing's customers is they switch to a different Boeing jet. Boeing's, you know, are they going to
lose business? Well, they have 400 737 MAX that are parked in deserts. They have a cost structure that's set up that's basically been rejiggered over the last 5 years to build 4,500 of these over the next few years. I think it's easier said than done that they just buy another Boeing jet. You know, I think there is some political aspects to this. I think it does get uglier before it gets better. I think Boeing knows that.
But how do you explain the stock, which has done almost nothing through all of this, with, you know, a lot lot of headwinds.
But it hasn't fallen. Are you making the point that it hasn't dropped?
I'm telling you, we all know we're pricing in a lot of uncertainty on the legislative side.
Because everybody keeps saying, it's going to get back into service soon. It's going to get back. It's like the sixth time you've said that.
Well, I mean, that was one of the problems at Boeing, actually.
Calhoun will change. Muhlenberg front running the FAA.
The FAA was not happy about this. But either way, you can't tell me that analysts around the street haven't changed their numbers on the company. I think they've made cutbacks. I think they've reassessed
free cash flow. To Dan's point, I do wonder what the passengers are going to say.
The stock's been trading in a range.
Are the passengers going to get back on the jet when it goes back into service? Assuming it goes back into service, we're going to find out. All right. There's a lot more coming your way here on Fast Money, including this.
It wasn't a very merry Christmas for all the stocks in our traders' portfolios. We'll find out which ones ended up being a lump of coal. Plus, it's the best stock of the decade. But can Netflix continue its run when the new year begins? We've got that and a lot more when Fast Money returns.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura's been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
All right, welcome back to Fast Money. We spoke a lot about Amazon's big day earlier, keeping busy not just with those getting out deliveries before Christmas, but processing returns over the next couple of days. And it is not the only retailer, no doubt, seeing customers bringing back the gifts they don't like, they don't need, or don't want. So, with that holiday spirit in mind,
we love the spirit of giving.
Yeah, it got us thinking.
Very
in the
nice
spirit
point.
Of holiday returns, what stocks do you wish you could send back? Tim Seymour, kick it off.
I think it has to be L Brands. So they of Bath and Body Works and, of course, Victoria's Secret. And you've got two different fortunes there, but really getting weighed down by Victoria's Secret. I don't think anything is going to change here. By the way, whenever we used to talk about L Brands, we would get gratuitous footage of people, models. Well, anyway, so we'll stop that. But the bottom line is this stock, as we went into the decade, was an $18 stock, traded up to $95. It will leave the exact same price at the end of this decade. Bath and Body Works is growing 7-8%. Victoria's Secret is contracting 4-5%. I think this is a stock that, despite activism and some dynamics that could change the boardroom, is left with a brand that is no mall to hang out in, which is really where
Would anybody pick up Tim's return? Anybody a buyer of LB?
No.
There we go. I think that says it all. All right, Gina, return to sender stock.
My return to sender is Apache. We talked about mean reversion, but this is definitely one about avoiding a falling knife. Sometimes things are cheap for a reason. You look at energy. Energy's at 19 times trailing. You look at Apache, they're 15 times. And the reason is that they are just having tremendous troubles with a really key drilling that they're doing down in Suriname. And they're not making any real effort there. I mean, they're making a lot of effort. They're not making any
headway
there. And they're having troubles elsewhere, which is to say that they are having real production troubles. How are you going to make money if you can't produce?
$68 stock.
It's not a cyclical energy call. You say this is a broken company.
This is a broken company.
Got it.
Okay, now, Victoria, do I understand it is the Houston resident on this panel? You are sending an oil and gas stock also back.
I am at least part of it, right? I'm not saying you have to completely sell out of ExxonMobil. That's our pick. But it maybe trim the position a little bit, not because we don't like it as a holding for the long term, but really because we think that you know, there's a better use of some of the funds we could have received from that over the past year. You look at that chart year to date on pricing. I mean, from the end of the first quarter, it's just been downhill all the way. So we think there were better uses of funds than keeping it in Exxon.
It's got Mobil. A AAA credit rating. It doesn't have a lot of debt relative to its cash flow. It's got a 5% dividend yield.
Well, that's why long term, I think it's an okay holding. But trim some of that position while it was doing the steady decline down. Use those proceeds for a higher quality name in your portfolio that was doing better this year.
Okay. And a final return to sender from Dan Nathan.
I think what Victoria says is really important. There's better uses of funds, right? That we don't all have finite amounts of capital like you there, big guy. I mean, well, what I'm saying is, so let's go back to Apple. Oh, we have it infinite. Yes, correct. Apple. And just to put, you know, I've been wrong on this thing for the last, let's say, 10% over the last month or so. The thing has gone parabolic. I think the last time it did that was in summer into the fall of 2018. It had a 20%+ return, almost in like a straight line over 2 months. Over the next few months, it dropped 45% peak to trough. This stock has had multiple 30%+ peak to trough declines in the last 5 years. So the only point I'm making is I'm not trying to get you out of Apple. I'm not your broker. I'm not your hedge fund manager. I don't own it for you. I'm just telling you that this stock, the biggest one in the world, has a tendency to lose a third to 40% of its value every couple years. And it usually happens after you have a parabolic move like this.
Okay, good stuff. Returning to sender to oil and gas, L Brands and Apple. All right, coming up, we're going to reveal the stock of the decade. It is just one name that has dominated the market in the past 10 years. But first, Tim taking the mound to pitch his next big idea. It's one housing-related stock that he says is a total home run. You ready?
Fast
ready?
Pitch. Yeah.
That's next.
Do it.
On Fast Money.
Fired up.
And welcome back to Fast Money. Home builders have been a red-hot trade for investors this year. But could the builder boom go bust? Here's Diane Olick with your 2020 housing playbook.
The housing market is a mix of highs and lows, so here's what to watch in 2020. First, the housing shortage will get worse. The number of homes for sale is already low, and demand is incredibly strong thanks to improving employment and the largest generation aging into its home buying years. The demand, however, is mostly on the low end where supply is leanest. That will cause prices to continue to overheat at the entry level while prices ease on the higher end where supply is more plentiful. Second, mortgage rates will stay low. Mortgage rates dropped in 2019 and will likely stay low through 2020 as uncertainty over a trade war and presidential election year keep investors heavy in the bond market. Mortgage rates loosely follow the yield on the 10-year Treasury. The only wild card is mortgage finance reform. If major changes are made to the roles of Fannie and Freddie, rates could finally break higher. And third, we're bullish on the builders. The combination of a major housing shortage and low interest rates will keep demand for new housing high, both single and multifamily. The home builders have been ramping up production, and in 2019, they finally started to pivot to entry-level homes. If they can afford to put up even more, big sales numbers will follow. Their headwinds, though, continue to be high prices for land, labor, and regulatory compliance.
That, of course, was Diane Olick reporting. Check out some of the best performing home builders in 2019. Masco, they're not a home builder, but they build the faucets and stuff that go into the houses. You got names like D.R. Horton, Pulte, and Lennar. They are actual home builders. You had MI, we talked about, the one in Columbus, Ohio. So will the home builder rally continue into next year, Victoria?
Yes, I think it will. We own Lennar. It's in our portfolio. We think there's a lot of strength going forward. With mortgage rates this low and with the momentum that we're seeing with the consumer, we think housing play has some room to go.
So affordability definitely helps that, too, because you have the accommodative Fed, as you mentioned earlier. Housing affordability is as affordable as we've seen. And we have had a shortage of inventory. D.R. Horton has actually benefited from that in particular. And I think that you're going to continue to see a sort of catch-up in that space.
You know, you're in L.A.
Yes.
I mean, there's no housing affordability there. We know you got to move out to Victorville to get a house that most people can afford. You know, we always talk about these big markets. Tim, is there any stock? I know you got your fast pitch coming up in a second, but is there any stock place like Bristol, Virginia? You know, off the radar places. We always talk about the big money of New York. That's not how you make the big money.
Well, I just want to point out that I think the macro, you know, one of the things you say in a lot of different investment constructs is you can't invest in a bad neighborhood. So literally bringing this into the housing space, I think rates are going higher in 2020. I don't think this is going to be good for housing stocks. They're totally correlated to the rates market. I think I would say two-thirds of your return was correlation and beta related to lower rates in 2019?
Well, I don't think they're going to go higher, though. I think they're going to go sideways. I think 2020 is actually going to be a weak year.
I think, I don't think rates are going to 3.5, but I do think that rates are the trend is higher. We just talked about a bunch of trades that are reflation trades. I mean, that's a higher rate environment. I don't think housing stocks can outperform it.
Well, just overlay the 30-year mortgage over the last couple of years. You look at it, it obviously went from 4.8 a year ago down to 3.8 where it is right now. And if you do the new home sales, you overlay that, we're right now at like almost 10-year highs. And back a year ago when they were at 4.8, which was a 10-year high almost in mortgage rates, they were much lower. So it really is a rate call. I do think it's interesting that the 10-year Treasury is having a lot of trouble here at 2%. But if we get into this period where, you know, you're talking about consumer, you're talking about all this stuff, we get all these headwinds to global growth out of the way, rates are going to have to go higher. I mean, that's exactly what happened in 2000.
Saying that, though, for a
while. Well, I'm saying is...
But if the economy is so strong, folks, the Fed should be going back.
I agree about it. I'm saying 2 years ago, everybody on CNBC, rates are going to 3%. Next thing you know, we're 1.5. All right, sticking with the housing space. Tim says there's one name that is building up for some big gains heading into the new year. Tim, head over to the Plaza, please. Give us your fast pitch.
Right. So housing stocks, how about a derivative on the housing sector? And ultimately, my fast pitch is Home Depot. This is a company that has re-rated also in the last decade. But I want to talk about a couple things that I think are really what's going on here. First of all, this is a stock that was a darling stock for much of certainly 2017, 2018. This stock's done nothing effectively in the last couple of years. I think there's been a massive sentiment reset, including the analyst day in mid-December, where they guided lower on margins. I think... If you think about, though, the fundamentals of the company and how they're running this business, they're reinvesting in technology. They're reinvesting in some of their pro services, by the way, which is a very high margin business. We're talking about macro. So we just talked a little bit about the macro trends. How about retail sales? We saw this also coming out of the holiday season, up 3.5%. 3.5% unemployment. The consumer is employed. There's a housing stock shortage. So what are you going to do? You're going to reinvest in the home you have, and you're going to take out an HELOC loan, which has never been easier to get. Finally, I just want to talk about that the chart is your friend, because, I mean, this is really a case where what we just talked about with a company that I think was a darling stock and one that really outperformed. But again, look, you basically had this sideways trend. And if you look, though, where this stock, and this is a two-year chart, you had a couple of these moments here where it had a chance to kind of break through the bottom end of the range, including the 200-day. I think it's been consolidating here. And in fact, like a lot of stocks we talk about on this show, after 2 years of doing nothing, if anything, this price action tells me it's going higher now.
All right, there's Tim's fast pitch. On Home Depot. Great use of the Telestrator there, Captain.
It's not my first rodeo, pal.
Thanks, Chief. That all makes sense. And if you believe what the ladies were saying about the economy, about the consumer, I think then get into Home Depot here. It is up 28% in the year. It's down about 6% from those highs. Really importantly, though, the earnings guidance that they gave a month and a half ago and then the investor meeting.
Very.
When you get that guidance, I just don't want to buy into two downgrades of guidance. So to me, I'm not a buyer here.
Okay, Victoria?
All right, I'm going to have to disagree here. I'm going with buy, and it all goes back to what we were just talking about.
No. She says
she disagrees
buy.
With Dan.
Why?
She disagreed with the disagreement, which is an agree.
Love it.
I think.
Just to confuse you. So,
you
yes,
like
we are a buyer. We think housing is going to continue to do well, and along with the remodeling, then Home Depot is a winner.
That is a buy.
Okay, so Thank I'm going to go with the no buy. So, no buy. You got sell, buy, and no buy.
Tuba's getting a lot of work on your Home Depot.
And so we just see the one Home Depot announcement that they just made is a massive investment project that's not going to take a quarter, 2 quarters. It's going to take several years. And I think it's going to depress the stock for some time as they swallow that investment. I think over time it can be a good investment that will pay itself back. But I think it's not just a 1 or 2 quarter problem. I think it's a multi-year investment problem.
All right, Tim, your fast pitch. Outside, high and outside. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Maybe just a little. Maybe you were leaning over the plate a little bit too much. I had to brush your back.
All right, well, there you go. Two no's and a yes for Home Depot. Okay, the desk is voted. But what about you all at home? Are you buying Tim's pitch on Home Depot? You can go vote on our Twitter poll at CNBC Fast Money. Reveal the results later on in the show. Coming up, it is the stock of the decade, but rising competition can put a big chill on this name. The details and debate when we come back. Plus, why options traders are making a big bet on the most important meal of the day. How can you make money off breakfast? We'll tell you coming up. All right, welcome back to Fast Money. Pretty much like every other sector, it's been a strong year for insert name here. No, consumer staples. General Mills, one of those, up a whopping 35% this year. And over in the options market, one trader is betting big on the most important meal of the day. Options play chief strategist Tony Zhang is at the Plasma to break down the action and what he is seeing on GAS options. Tony.
So General Mills does not trade very actively. Normally, less than 4,000 contracts are traded. But today, we saw almost 30,000 contracts trade on a single trade. This was a roll, and I get asked a lot of questions about the strategy. So let's break this down. Today, what we saw was actually an investor already owns almost 50,000 contracts of the $50 call options that expire in April. Now, he sold these at $375, collecting almost $5.6 million in premium, and he took that to buy 14,400 contracts of the same $50 calls expiring in January 2021, paying $545 for that. So that net was about $7.8 million. So he spent almost a little over $2 million to basically extend this trade by about 8 months. And to understand this trade, I think we got to take a look at the chart. So the original April options were established back here in around September. And I think the trader was looking for a breakout. This stock has traded within a tight range, but as you can see, that trade did not materialize. So what we're seeing is we have to zoom out to about a five-year chart here. And to my eye here, what you have here is a big bottoming formation, an inverted head and shoulders that has been forming. And I think the trader just wants to buy a little bit more time, looking at maybe about a $60 target on this particular trade by the January 2021.
All right, watching GIS. Great stuff. Tony, thank you very much. Tony Zhang.
Thank you.
For more options action, of course, you can check out the full show tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. All right, up next, the one stock that has outperformed every other in the S&P 500 over the past 10 years. As always, live at the NASDAQ. More Fast Money still ahead. All right, welcome back to Fast Money. We've been teasing it out all show long. We're talking about the reveal of the stock of the decade. That stock is, Netflix.
Nice job.
Wow, the stock dominating the 2010s, climbing more than 4,000%, Tim.
Yes.
Over the past 10 years, Netflix has revolutionized the content distribution landscape, we're told. It's introduced millions of people to video streaming and reshaped the very idea of the blockbuster hit. Not only is Netflix the S&P's best performer, it's outperforming Hollywood at its own game. Netflix scored 15 Oscar nominations in 2019 alone and has won 43 primetime Emmys since the year 2013. But as Netflix has evolved, so has the streaming landscape. There are a lot more players in the game. So can Netflix remain in the spotlight in 2020, or is this curtains for the stock? Julia Boorstin is back at CNBC HQ with more. That was a long read, Julia.
Well, Brian, Netflix did define an entirely new industry of streaming video, which has disrupted the pay TV business as well as the movie industry. And now the original streamer is facing a slew of new competitors. The first wave of new rivals, Apple TV Plus, launching November 1st, which is free with the purchase of any Apple device. It was followed by Disney Plus on November 12th, drawing 10 million signups in its first day. We'll have to see whether either of these eat into Netflix's fourth quarter subscribers. And then coming up next in April, CNBC's parent company, NBC Universal, is set to launch ad-supported Peacock, which will include a free option as well as a paid option. And then that will be followed in May by the launch of AT&T's HBO Max. Now, all of these rivals aren't just competing for consumers. They're also fighting for content, which is and will continue to push content costs higher. Now, Netflix forecasts the addition of 600,000 subscribers in the U.S. added in the fourth quarter. That's slightly more than it added last quarter. And it does say it expects to add 7 million subscribers overseas in Q4. Though remember, those international subscribers don't pay as much as those do here in the U.S. Brian?
All right, Julia, thank you very much. All right, quick comment. Anybody on Netflix? Stock of the decade.
I, first of all, this is the miss of the decade for me. So to be clear, I mean, I kept saying too expensive. I do think that the market is demanding profitability from all companies in a different way. And the competitive landscape, like the Irishman, has been a disappointment. I mean, things that you've expected out of these guys, maybe not in terms of the quality, but in terms of the viewership. I would never besmirch Mr. Scorsese.
I'll just make one point about buying it into the new decade. I would wait until they report earnings in mid-January. If they have their third consecutive U.S. Subscriber miss of expectations, yeah, I just don't think you're going to want to own it in 2020, if that's the case.
So much for the content.
Well, yeah, and going forward, I mean, obviously there's new competitors coming out, and Julia talked about that. But I think what we also have to realize is that these competitors, this is not their only revenue stream that they have. For Netflix, this is it. This is all they have. When you're looking at Apple and Disney, they have other sources of revenue that they can use, whether it's to buy content, develop content, or just to support that system right now because they're doing it at such a cheap price.
But the bulls would say, but that's why they're good. That's what they're good with, because that's all they do, and that's how they've made it. All right, coming up, your final trades. Stick around. All right, welcome back. Check out this video. So it looks like a normal package delivery driver just doing his job. He walks up, puts down a package, takes a confirmation photo, but not so fast. He then picks it back up and apparently steals it. Police say they have reached out to Amazon to help identify the driver, but the company was less than cooperative, saying they would only help track down the man if a subpoena was served. That's a boo. All right.
That is
time now to reveal the results from Tim's fast pitch on Home Depot. This one was close, but Tim, sad to say, 49% of viewers at home do not agree with you.
That means I won.
Yeah, because that means 51% did.
Hold on.
This
has never happened before.
This show is not called Math Money for a reason, apparently.
Hold on a second. If I got 51, if I had to guess, someone might have
flipped. Let's do our final trade. Tim, why don't you start us off?
All right, so let's put you over the top because I am muttering. Home Depot, you have to dance with the one that brung you. Again, I think a conservative guide here, you get to roughly 15 times. You're at a $255 stock.
Okay, I'm going for Disney. The Disney Plus obviously outperformed, but they've also shown pricing power with their parks. That's continuing.
Victoria?
We're buying MasterCard, good revenues, good margins, and they're buying back stock.
Dan?
Yeah, Netflix, again, I'm not a buyer after this 15% run into the new year.
All right, guys, really appreciate that. Thanks
nice
a lot. 49%, good win.
Thank you.
Mad Money with Jim starts right now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.